that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to me.
Greetings, I'm Chuck Foster. Join me at 2 p.m. Sundays for Reggae Central, playing ska, rock steady, roots, dub, and dancehall. New releases, old favorites, and delightful obscurities right here on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A.
Hey, this is Teddy Robinson, your soul brother to the night. Join me every Sunday night, Monday morning, for the Stairway to Heaven from 3 a.m. until 5:30 a.m. Check this out.
That's what love is made of. That's 2 minutes and 57 seconds of Smokey Robinson and the Miracles.
To Delphonics right now, and didn't I blow your mind this time? Welcome to the Stairway to Heaven. I'm in that groove at the present moment. We're going to rewind the machine and go back with Stevie Wonder.
Kind of telling the stories of what's going on in the streets of love and things of that nature, in words and in music. You listen long enough, you know, you just may find your story somewhere in the nooks and crannies of the classic soul music.
It's groovy, it's funky, and it's classic soul. Every Sunday night, Monday morning, from 3 a.m. until 5:30 a.m. right here on KPFK 90.7 FM. You will dig it.
Hi, this is Angelique Kidjo, and you're listening to People Powered Radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at www.kpfk.org. Peace and love.
And this is Alan Minsky live on KPFK's airwaves. I'm so thrilled to be here. And I'm sitting in for Susie Weissman. Susie Weissman is a conference in the Basque Country. And it's a long way to travel. And by the way, it's so great to have Susie back on air. I know she took a little hiatus. Probably KPFK listeners were aware that had something to do with, health concerns. But Susie is in great shape and in great health. And that is a blessing to all of us. What a fantastic programmer. I, of course, am Alan Minsky, and I'm the former program director here. And I have another job now, which I will confess over airwaves. But I'm not going to be talking about that institution that I'm honored to be executive director of, both of the 501c4 called Progressives for Democracy in America and a federal PAC called Progressive Democrats of America. However, on this show today, I want to do something very distinctive, and I want to do this because it is, don't run away, folks. This isn't going to be just pitching KPFK, but a way of honoring KPFK. I want to hear from you, the listeners, across this hour. You can call in at 818-985-5735, the same number you can call to donate. If you hit 1, you'll go into the queue to get on air. If you hit 2, you can donate. Of course, encourage everybody to do both. And I'd love to hear from you. So what are we going to talk about? In my job, what I do is I have to ask the question to myself over and over again. Can the American political system, as it's in the common sense understanding of it, be responsive to the social crises we face in this society and as they relate to crises around the world in the 21st century? Okay? So the work I do, I, of course, have to believe the answer is yes. I know many people out there are skeptical about that, and I think with very good reason. And so what I intend to do in a little bit is just sort of frame that question a little bit in a more deep way and then ask for people's reflections on both what I say but on the general subject. How capable is our, again, very money-dominated, no doubt, and dominated by powerful people and powerful interests, our democratic republic, our democratic system is, to the problems we face in our society? And because it is Earth Day weekend, problems around the world, okay? So that's the question that I'd like to put to you. And the reason I got this idea in my head, and I could, of course, brought two guests on and did the standard thing, and in some respects, of course, I was a little reluctant to do that because, you know, you obviously have to prepare deeply, as we all do at KPFK, as Susie Weissman does spectacularly every week, you know, on her show. You know, you prepare around the work of the guests that you have and you frame with them. And by the way, I'm hearing a little bit of background noise. I'm not sure what it is. Oh, I think it slips through from the other room. Is that what it is? It does. Okay. And so obviously we're at new studios here at KPFK. This is the first time I've been an extended way on the mic here. I've dropped in a few times to do some pitches during fun drives, and I was really happy to be able to touch base with my friends on the Poacher Hour of Power in a brief cameo on Friday. But here I am live, and I'm interested in taking your phone calls again at 818-985-5735. And the really big issue, I think, facing American society is our democracy, the vulnerability of our democracy to what really seems like at this point a pretty explicit project that I view as defending the power of our oligarchs in our society. We've had incredible imbalance in wealth distribution over the last 40 years, 45 years. And I don't think it's surprising that we arrive at the conservative of the two political parties in what effectively remains a two-party system in the United States, you know, electoral system, is basically looking to dismantle the traditional apparatus of democracy in the society, which will then perpetuate the power of the contemporary oligarchs, right? And I think you can look at you really have to look at the book How Democracies Die by two Harvard political scientists, you know, looking at things from a liberal, classical sort of American university liberal intellectual tradition, which dominates the political science field in American universities, that they look at countries like Russia, Hungary, other examples, Brazil closely, but again, a narrow escape there with Bolsonaro, that there's effectively a reactionary international out there. Steve Bannon's a central figure in this, organizing among the groups to, again, dismantle the sort of practices and just the idea that the public assumes we will have a competitive set of democratic elections, but to dismantle that apparatus and bring us to the point where you have these candidates like Putin and Orbán's who win with 70% support, and there's not really any open free speech or democracy in the society. Of course, that's very distant from what we've had in the United States, even as we've had a very perverted democratic system. So the question is, you know, I think one of the reasons that the Trumpian MAGA reactionary movement can come really be so competitive when it so explicitly has no respect for the democratic norms that uphold the constitutional Republican democratic system is because the public is so profoundly dissatisfied with the political class and the political system as it is in its ability to actually respond to the crises and the issues of our time. So I'd like to take your calls at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. And I'd also like you to donate to KPFK this hour. And how are these two things related? Well, let me ask you this, okay? There is simply not going to be any radio station in Southern California, no major media outlet in Southern California or in the country that has the reach of the corporate media still and the power to influence of the corporate media and of NPR that will ask this question and not address it in an honest way. They will not, for instance, say the word in a way that where it's all that it does is supposed to be good and glorious, which is capitalism. What role does capitalism play in all of this? And again, not only that, but very explicitly 21st century American capitalism. How much is this erosion or potential erosion of our system in relationship to structures that are in place because of the classical structures of capitalism, or are they distinctive to 21st century capitalism? So that's one question, right? By the way, I think it's important, too, to consider the things that are good about American society, even its contemporary configuration. And again, I think these are threatened and could be threatened by a further right-wing rise through the Trumpian movement, which, of course, I believe is very much worth defeating, okay? And those are the things about, you know, by the way, I'd have to say, following the show that is just on, and I am so unbelievably proud of this station to have had Think Outside the Cage on its airways for as long as it's been on. Because again, when we're talking about addressing the social crises in the United States in the 21st century, and can our democratic system address them, there are many things that need to be addressed. But I also think one of the things that almost never gets addressed in a consistent way in the mainstream media is the fact that this society warehouses human beings like no society in human history. I'm sorry, Stalin's gulags, at the level of having a huge population populate them, and yes, they had a much, much higher death rate than in the American carceral system. Clearly, they were a crime against humanity. But at what point and how long ago did the existence and persistence of the U.S. prison industrial complex become a severe crime against humanity? I would say sometime, a long time ago. And it certainly got much worse with the mass incarceration increases during the Democratic Clinton administration that came about because of the 1990s crime bill. But to be warehousing 2 million people in a society and what life is like for human beings inside the American prison system, and the establishment and the oligarchs who run our society have the gall to scold other countries, this is a crime against humanity, you know, that ranks right up there with anything going on in the world right now. You're not going to hear that on NPR. You're not going to hear that discussed in corporate media. You're not going to hear that returned to in a way that it gains traction. But at KPFK, that kind of consideration is front and center. And that's the reason you should donate at 818-985-5735, to consider the question not just from the liberal perspective that, oh, Trump, horrible, horrible thing, it's all because of Trump and Trump must be defeated, and not look at the underlying reasons why a figure like Trump rises up and challenges to unravel the Democratic Republic of the United States. Because here's the thing right now. I do, of course, think it's essential that we defeat Trump. But we're talking about defeating Trump through the vehicle of a president who is engaged in currently in an ongoing way, especially with more important votes that have happened at the UN and votes that have happened in Congress, so a political party, the Democratic Party, that I believe are sanctioning crimes that are basically unforgivable. And they too are crimes against humanity. And of course, I'm talking about the situation and the slaughter in Gaza. I mean, the treatment of the people who are the population of Gaza is whatever your interpretation of the history leading up to this, whatever your interpretation of the Hamas attacks on October 7th, what has transpired in Gaza could not be transpiring without support from the U.S. government. I think that's understood by everybody who looks at the situation. And the slaughter that is involved there. And again, you can debate whether it's genocide or not. You can debate whether the specific term apartheid applies to the system that the Palestinians lived under beforehand. All of it is just way off the charts wrong if you have any kind of moral compass, okay? Ethnostates exist around the world, but with active oppression and abuse of a population like we've seen in the Palestinians. And then it goes up to a level, I mean, I don't want to cite Spinal Tap, but taking it to 11 comes to mind in my stupid imagination of what's transpired in Gaza and in Palestine. So it's necessary to defeat Trump, and it's necessary for all good-hearted people to oppose what's going on in Israel and Gaza. And if it's necessary to defeat Trump, then you realize you're in the very, very uncomfortable moral position of calling upon people to support voting for a president and to vote for a party across the country that is complicit in that. But Trump does represent, in my opinion, the election of Trump would represent potentially through the courts and through the empowerment of the MAGA movement, the dismantling of, again, a money-saturated democratic system that needs to be become an honest democratic system. But that opportunity just seemingly could be gone from us with the election of Trump. So it is making, not making the mistake of the German people in 1933, not to have the left be in coalition with moderates in order to defeat the fascists. I think that's essential. But that doesn't negate the question I want people to address today. Do you have confidence that our political system can address the major issues of the 21st century? I mentioned mass incarceration in the criminal justice system, and I mentioned I think it's important to mention on Earth Day weekend the inability of the political elites in the United States to in any way, shape, or form honestly address the climate emergency. By the way, if you think that the Democratic Party has done a good job on that, you actually can look at oil production and fossil fuel production in the United States of America, but also just oil production, not natural gas, but just oil production. And it starts skyrocketing with the development of fracking under the Obama administration. And, you know, Al Gore's movie was was 10 years before that. There was no intellectual excuses at that point. And the Obama administration, their policy was basically drill, baby, drill and burn, baby, burn to the planet. I'm sorry. Biden administration's been a little better, but not as good as it needs to be by any shape or form. I mean, there have been incentives that have been put in place, but basically market incentives to try to further develop, you know, renewable energy and non-nuclear renewable energy, also some nuclear, which is really wrongheaded, of course. I mean, this, you know, people who think that that's a way to go and what's necessary. When you have the technology to really reduce, the technology exists to reduce fossil fuel production down to 10% of what it is, at least. And there's really no excuse for any of it. But, you know, people will make the argument that there's certain bursts of energy that are necessary for the maintenance of a modern society. And that so far, renewable energies can't produce those bursts of energies like in steel manufacturing. Airplanes are another thing. But if you take it down to 10%, I mean, then you have some, you know, combine it with creating more, you know, carbon-absorbing vegetation around the world in ways that fit with, you know, the indigenous plant life before the era of colonialism. I think you can get some way towards having the reduction of carbon in the atmosphere, even if that technology isn't further developed to create the bursts I'm describing. But our government isn't doing that, okay? So can our democracy with all – I mean, what would it require for our democracy to be able to address those things? And is it actually a flaw within the system or working within the system? And, of course, I think you can guess, given what I'm doing. I'm certainly hoping and praying and believing that it's possible. But it's going to take institutions like KPFK Radio asking these kind of questions – with this kind of depth and going to the heart of the issue, which hopefully I'm doing right now and you'd agree that I am, that allows the even glimmer of hope that we can become an honest democratic society. Clearly levels of just the, I don't think the population, I mean, you look at even things like late night TV and the mere fact that the, you know, kind of narrative around who the president is, who the, you know, what's the subject on any given day of the monologues on late night TV? Clearly the population is engaged with political consideration. Does the public have an aversion to civic engagement like they do doing, everybody would have aversion to doing their homework when they're in high school or in college? I don't think so. I think people want to feel empowered and feel controlled. And I don't think that they see the contemporary political system as it is operated to do that for them. Now, of course, I certainly believed that something shifted and was promising about the Sanders campaigns in 2016 and 2020, the rise of the squad, though, again, nothing in the country quite matches the kind of euphoria and energy and focus that presidential campaigns can do. And obviously, having the absence of a competitive left progressive alternative, the large swaths of youth who were motivated by the Sanders campaigns in a presidential cycle this time, they have nothing to motivate them except ire over the state of the world, the absence of really addressing the climate emergency. By the way, outside the White House today, there's a demonstration going on, actually right now as I'm speaking, from the students, the young people, not students necessarily, who have brought a lawsuit against the federal government, the Juliana 21, as they're called. That's the analog to the Montana State court case in which young people challenged the state of Montana and won for their failure to adequately address the climate emergency. And the Juliana case is the federal example of it. And today, it being Earth Day weekend, there's a demonstration about that right now outside the White House because the response hasn't been adequate. And given all the research capacity that the United States has, really, which exceeds that of any other country in the world, it's not acceptable that we do not address that adequately. And again, yet our political system, supposedly a democratic system, doesn't do that. The oligarchic structure, the wealth inequality, homelessness, and then all the social indices of despair that exist in the United States. Can our democratic system address these things? So 818-985-5735. If you hit number one, I will be speaking to you in a few minutes. And if you hit number two, please donate. And again, I encourage everybody to consider donating right now, whatever they can get. For a $65 pledge, and I'm going to ask, do we have folks calling in? And we'll get them on the air in about 5 minutes. I have one other tale I want to tell, though. I meant to start with this because, of course, I want to set up around the question I just framed. But I had an interesting experience yesterday. I'm really into French baguettes, okay? And the reason I'm into French baguettes partly is reflective of my politics. If people don't know, beginning with the French Revolution in the country of France, they have consistently now for, what is this, 1789 through to the present, about, you know, 240, 235 years. And I'm not sure exactly what year during the French Revolution. They started to supplement bread prices. The government did. And they've done it consistently since that time. And even to this day, a French baguette, which is a sublime item of food, a baked item of food. I know we're not supposed to be promoting carbs, but and white bread too is carbs. But French baguettes are amazing, okay? And to this day, because of that supplementation, the average, for the first time in the history of the French Republic, they now have gone over €1 cost, approximately a $1 cost. And by the way, Gary, I'm wondering if we have callers calling in to get on the air. No, not yet. People calling. Come on, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. I want to hear your thoughts about whether you think our democratic republic, our democratic system, our electoral system, with the dominance of the Democratic and the Republican parties, the dominance of the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. I can talk more about this. I can monologue about it. But I'm interested in what you think about it. I want to know what Los Angelinos, people in Southern California, anyone listening to KPFK around the world, thinks about the capacity of our democratic system to address the issues we're facing in the 21st century, locally, nationally, globally. Okay? So 818-985-5735. And I don't want you to pull any punches. I don't want to, you know, have you, you know, be entirely constrained by just this deep desire to defeat Donald Trump. Can our system address – we have deep endemic problems that are never addressed in this society. I'll get back to that. But I want to talk more about baguettes, and I'll hopefully you'll enjoy this. While the calls come in, once I'm done with the story, I want to take calls from listeners, hear what you think about and again, you push one when you call. You go through to master control. Your name gets put on the board, and I can get in the dialogue with you. You push two, and you donate. So we've had a few people donate already. We haven't gotten people who've gotten into the queue to talk. I find that a little hard to believe. So, you know, call now, 818-985-5735, push one. Okay, back to the baguettes. So, I don't know. I'm into them because they're the signifier of the kind of thing that government should do to make sure that a population can be fed. So these fantastically, you know, incredibly fetishized bakery items that the whole world thinks are an exemplar bakery item in the country of France, for the first time ever recently, the cost of a baguette rose over a dollar. So I, when I was a kid and I had very little money, found myself in France. I grew up partly in Italy. Found myself in France. Found myself in Paris. And I could go get a baguette, this incredible, you know, it's enough food for a day. I'm, of course, not good, not just to eat bread, but you could live off it, right? For about, at the time, it was like 30 cents. And then you'd get this butter and just the ham to go with the butter. And that's a classic French sandwich. And I just, you know, it was about, you know, at that time, like $1.50 for the ham. Even butter, of course, you had to buy a little bit more. So that also was about $1.50. And I had enough food for the whole day, for sure. And you get to be in Paris, right? And go to whatever you're going to do. Go to, I mean, bookstores and look at the architecture and talk to the people and listen to this, find the street performances and just go to museums and stuff like that. But the food was so cheap because of the baguette. So I'm interested in what the best baguette is in Los Angeles. And I find a few places that are really, really good. But then I'm told that there's a bakery on La Brea called République that had won the award, something like the James Beard Award. I don't know if that James Beard is. People probably know who James Beard is. I don't know who James Beard is. National Award for the best baguette in the country, okay? And it's called République. And I'd gone to a few that I thought were really good. By the way, Porto Bakery right near here has got a pretty good French baguette. And I think that's really great price of, I think, $275. It's either $275 or $375. It's one of the best bargains for a baguette. Now, believe me, it all should be about a dollar. I've already said that, right? So Pouchon downtown's good. I think that one's $375 or $475. There are a few others. Too many, even the ones that people think are good, taste like Kleenex. Why is it so difficult to create a great French baguette outside of France? I don't know. But people tell me this one, Republique, is the best. So I go there yesterday. It's on La Brea right near Wilshire, one block, in the first block north of Wilshire on the east side. And it's a really obviously upscale place. Now, in that neighborhood, Gary Baca, there are a bunch of homeless people. There's a bunch of homeless people around Republique, okay? And I get to the window, two things. How much is the baguette? The most expensive one I found so far was $4.75. It's friggin' $6.75 for a loaf of bread, okay? First of all. Second of all, they do not take cash. They only take credit card. So when I encounter that, and it's true at Dodger Stadium now, and at Dodger Stadium, I have yet to say this to people. And by the way, baseball is a game that's much less expensive to go to a game traditionally. The idea that you can't pay cash, that you have to sign up for a credit card, it's not only classist. For poor people, it's basically telling them to participate in this, you know, market exchange. You have to risk incredible interest rate debt, okay? It is so darn classist, okay? So here's the thing. $6.75 for a baguette. I got it. Okay, it's a hell of a baguette. Okay, can't buy it with cash, and it's $6.75. It is more or less six times more expensive than the average baguette in the country of France, where the baguettes are just as good as they are. Okay, here's the thing. République, you should be called oligarch. Oligarch, I think that's how you pronounce it in French, too. Oligarchique, maybe, oligarch. They should not be called République. It is an absolute disgrace that they're allowed to use that name. And, of course, all the clientele clearly doing better off than the average Los Angelino, average Southern Californian in a neighborhood with a proliferation of homeless people. You can only use a credit card, and the people's bread costs six times as much as it does in France, where it's every bit as good. So, you know, Republique, I think a few things. I suggest to you either change your name to Oligarch, okay, as opposed to Republic, because that's more reflective of the kind of economy that you're endorsing. And then on top of that, I really think to atone for your sins, you should at least set two prices. $6.75 for credit card. Go ahead, keep it. Most of the people who are going in, if you're using credit card, $6.75. But if you bring cash, it's a dollar there. And then I think you'd have you can at least hold on to the name you have and not be, I think people should go up and say you should be called Oligarch as opposed to Republique. Anyway, that was my little anecdote for the day. And wherever you encounter credit card only, please let the people know that the businesses that is classist. Okay? So, yeah. Anyway, we got a caller. We got Mo from Granada Hills. Welcome, Mo, to KPFK Radio. And I just want to remind people, if you call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, number one, you can get right on air. And again, the question is, do you believe that our democratic system, with all of the saturation of money and the over-influence of wealthy people and powerful institutions, can respond to the crises of the society? Mo, first, your take, and then I'm going to elaborate more on what those crises are that just don't get addressed right now by our governmental system. Mo, your thoughts.
Yes. Good morning, Alan. Thanks for all that you do.
Thank you.
Yes, I believe we could. And the only candidate who's addressing everything, you know, has a comprehensive, in-depth, program, is being totally blacked out, you know, in the media. I can understand in the, mainstream media, but even the progressive radio and, progressives, there is no mention of Marianne Williamson and her programs and who's been looking into the, root causes of the problem and has a comprehensive program to address all these problems we are faced with.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, I think I can answer that as it exists. I think the simple answer is it's very tough to run against an incumbent president within a party, because all of the party apparatus is going to – if you think they put their finger on the scales for Hillary over Bernie, they're going to do it to the max with a sitting president, and they did it. And, you know, right off the bat when she announced her candidacy, I remember in a highly condescending way the White House press spokesperson made some jibe at her and some joke at her expense. And, you know, it's – it again, I think you have a corporate media that is – basically has set in motion the idea not only that there's a two-party system, but that the establishments of the two parties get to define what they want and they're going to reflect it. I mean, that just seems to be what matches up in especially all of these opining media outlets like MSNBC and CNN, which, you know, now I think have more traction than, say, the classical news outlets like CBS News, ABC News, NBC News. In many respects, even though they don't get very high ratings, the way that things like, again, the like talk shows on late at night, which, you know, every night they lead with the politics, you know, it's a real phenomenon. And it's this very strange thing, too, that we have these kind of politicians who ostensibly have this oppositional posture, but really just conform to the mainstream norms. And here I'm thinking of, you know, Colbert, Seth Meyer. As much as people out there may like them, they really, really are – at this point, they're sort of adjuncts to the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And then they reflect this. So it's not just CNN and MSNBC, but they do tend to play off of clips from those networks, or they negatively play off clips from Fox News. And, of course, the right-wing media has its own infrastructure. And the last thing the right-wing media really is going to do – I mean, they're going to promote – you know, Bernie Sanders got a lot of interviews on Fox when he first announced in 2016. And, you know, some people questioned it. And I think it probably helped him gain traction. But, of course, they were always sort of like wanting to go up against him in the mainstream election because they thought they could beat him. Now, I think that would have been wrongheaded. And I thought Sanders in 2016 really could have beaten Trump. But there's this whole apparatus of the establishment, and they're not going to give a voice to or take or say you can't take seriously. And it just builds and builds, and people don't go for it. And then the other thing that happened is that you do have an incumbent. He's sort of expected to win. The people who vote in the Democratic primaries are accepting that logic. And so the results weren't that good, even when I think Marianne Williamson was touring these states. And my understanding is she was getting strong response from her audience, but that wasn't being reflected in her votes. So, you know, it's quite unfortunate because I agree with you. She had much more of an intelligent structural critique of our problems. And of course the other thing is, you know, she didn't hold office and, you know, they had a sort of a tack line they could go after her because of, they just knew they're going to do that. They're going to be shameless in getting an attack line on somebody they want to keep silenced and marginalized. And I think their goal this cycle with challengers has been not to allow competition like you had with Sanders. So, I mean, I think Clinton was in a – I have no sympathy for the Clinton campaign of 2016, but I think she was in this weird double bind of, okay, we need – we clearly Sanders has traction. We need his voters to win in November. How do we, you know, sort of like defeat him but draw these people in and get – and sort of like thrive off of their motivation? It didn't really work for him in the end. Obviously, they lost, though, you know, she won the popular vote. Of course, Sanders is much more supportive himself of Biden, and that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch just sort of objectively. But, yeah, Mo, thank you for the call. Great question.
Yes. And, yeah. You know, I understand all that you said, Alan, right. You know, regarding the mainstream media. But why is it that even KPFK is not, you know, giving her some time in the to discuss her solutions to the problems and
I think she's actually still maintaining her campaign. I got an email from her campaign saying something about Oregon, and Oregon is on May 21st. So I know that she had suspended her campaign and then she returned to it, even though Biden, I mean, she's quite honest when I've heard her about, you know, what her chances have been. And now, of course, Biden has won enough primaries to have guaranteed himself a majority. But she's continuing the campaign. And I know that she's done so at times in coordination with the very important Uncommitted and Ceasefire. I don't work at KPFK. I'm just a filling guest right now, so I can't speak to your question about KPFK. But I certainly, had I been program director, would not have discouraged anybody from interviewing Marianne Williamson. So I can't speak to that. And We do have so many shows here, I can't speak to how many gave her an opportunity to be on air. I certainly would have welcomed it had I been here, but I don't work here anymore. But Mo, thank you so much. And number three, we have Jessica in Ventura. Must apparently comment on my credit card comment pertaining to Republic Bakery with their fine baguettes and their absolute contempt for French radical history. And they do not deserve to use the word republic. They should be called oligarch. Jessica, what's up?
Hey, you're coming through really quiet on my phone. Let me try something here.
Okay.
All right, that's better. Sorry, I was trying to use speakerphone, but...
Good.
So my comment is, like, what is, like, last time I checked, like, every single dollar bill that I've ever seen, used, exchanged, looked at in my life, says right on it. Hold on, now I got to turn down my radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please turn your, if you're calling in, please turn off your radio. Yeah. You know, we have a delay
right
there,
it,
so it's confusing.
It's available for all legal tender, you know, for public and private debts, all debts that it is legal tender.
Ah.
And I've gone, there's several businesses in my town that do not take, like, I live in Ventura.
Right.
They don't take cash.
Right.
I tried to pay at the community college for something the other day, and I was told I could not pay cash.
Wow.
You know, I think it's messed up, and
it's,
I want to know,
up.
How
yeah.
is that legal?
Yeah, I agree. As a journalist, maybe I'll try to, maybe next time I go down, it's a weird thing for me with Republic. By the way, this is another thing.
It's
another thing
it's
too.
Hard, you know?
Yeah. There's another thing too, by the way. I really encourage everybody out there at KPFK, whenever they're at a place, I was pleasantly surprised in my fetish for this sandwich. And where do you get the same ham from Paris, the Jambon de Paris? You do have to go to a sort of gourmet store. So I went to Bristol Farms and I actually got an exchange with the manager there. It was actually really pleasant. So Bristol Farms, people may be familiar with it. It's sort of this high-end semi-luxury grocers around L.A. They, you know, all their food behind this, at least at this one, they do give to a homeless shelter so that it can feed people once it's like a day or two old. So props to them.
Yeah.
Whole Foods does not. Jeff Bezos, all that stuff that's sitting back
don't
there.
Don't give your money to Jeff Bezos.
There you go.
Don't give your money to Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, and their baguettes are crap too, so yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you. No, you raise a great point. I encourage people to challenge businesses that do this. You're right. It says that on a dollar bill. How can they refuse it? And what right do they
and
have to refuse it? And it's so classist.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so classist.
It's so classist.
Right.
Like, who are the people that don't have a credit card?
Right.
Who are the people that don't have a credit card?
Right. And the people who don't have a credit card, you're basically telling them if you want to participate in this market exchange, you're going to accrue an extra 25% that you're probably not going to be able to pay. It's going to wreck your life, wreck your credit, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's way messed up.
No, it's super messed up. And then I had one more comment on something that you said while you were responding to the other caller.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, like, you know, that the so-called alternative media, like Stephen Colbert and, like, what's-his-face who's on it now, Oliver. Anyway, so the politicians, like, you're like, it's not news. Like, you said they lead with politics. It's not news that politicians are trying to manipulate us by playing on our emotions. You know? That's not even news. Why are we talking about it?
Right.
So
right.
That's just my comment. All right, I'll get off the air now.
No, thank you so much for your call, Jessica. Fantastic. And now,
thank you.
Thank you. And I want to now go to Rick on number two. And how you doing, Rick? And we'll get to other people's calls. And please turn your radio off because there's a delay, and it's quite confusing if you have it on. There's a delay because, you know, you or I could slip up and say some naughty words, and we get in trouble with the FCC as if it was like 1972 still. And so... please turn your radio off. And Rick, welcome to KPFK. What's on your mind? Rick, are you with us? I think we maybe should move past Rick. And let me now do this again. Okay, you can call in and talk to me. And by the way, Mike, you're on deck. You can call and talk to me at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. If you select one, you can get in the queue to talk to me on air. And if you select two, which I encourage everybody to do, select number two and donate to KPFK. Look, we haven't gotten as in-depth in it as possible. And so let me do this now before we go to Mike on for the next comment. Look, the United States of America is a very, very, very wealthy country. In my opinion, the wealth was built up in the post-World War II period, and the people who managed the U.S. economy, which at that time was sort of seen as having this kind of progressive Keynesian economic slant, which was an outgrowth of the New Deal and the response to the Great Depression and the Roosevelt administration, which was a very creative approach to, you know, both protecting capitalism and the Republican democracy in the society as opposed to fascism or communism at the time. But also after World War II, you got into a superpower competition with the Soviet Union. Soviet Union was the second wealthiest country in the world, by the way, coming out of World War II. And, you know, Khrushchev and Nixon had their famous exchanges. And I think the United States, the people who were organizing the society for a few decades there recognized the ingenuity of the Rooseveltian structures. They continued them. And it's in that period where suburbia develops. And suburbia has – the expansion of suburbia – the level of households that own homes, and of course this was very racist in its distribution at the time. In fact, the racial wealth gap between black and white Americans is really an outgrowth of the incredible boom in wealth that occurred in the post-war period and redlining and the fact that the Dixiecrats controlled the government money in the Southeast, kept the wealth out of the hands of black Americans. And that is a historical sin we would, of course, have to rectify. One example, can our democratic republican system, money saturated, it is now actually be capable of addressing these things? I want to believe yes, but can it? I wonder what people think about that. Because I think the yes answer is really significant for why what will motivate people in the end to vote against Trump and defeat Trump this time. If people now feel that this just cannot be handled by our political system, then I think Trump is in a pole position to not only win but further erode our democracy because people's faith in the system has collapsed. I want to go more into the endemic problems that don't get addressed next time I go on a little volley here. But Mike in L.A., you're up next. What's on your mind?
Hi, Alan. Just an update. The euro now is $1.065, so those baguettes are even more costly than you thought. The other issue that you mentioned,
that's 1.06. So yeah, the average price is still down around 1 euro, and the highest apparently is 1.3 euros right now. So right. So that would still only be about $1.25. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, one other inequality in current financial institutions that strikes me all the time is that if you don't have a smartphone, you're basically screwed.
Yeah,
you cannot do this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
But on the original question, I was in a dilemma this spring with the California primary because I wanted so much to vote for Joe Biden because he's been so good with everything else. That what was happening in the Middle East, I just left it to a write-in. Ceasefire
right.
in Gaza,
right.
And I'm going to be in a really bad place in November if, in fact, this is not the start of some reining in of Bibi Netanyahu.
Right, right.
We noticed that the vengeance strike against Iran after the vengeance strike against Israel, after the vengeance strike against Iran,
right. Right.
It was more of a symbolic thing again.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that maybe the screws are being put on Bibi, and the price for his one-ton bombs is to not use them.
Well, and sadly, now that goes over to the Senate, where if I can count votes, and that's part of my job these days in those bodies, the level of opposition has been much lower than in the House. So it's looking like he's going to get his tranche of money. And, you know, and I think we know that he would rather have Trump be president. So you know, I don't know what, you know, sometimes the capacity of these mainstream Democrats, and they get all this advice from these super high paid consultants, and talk about failing upwards. These people are absolute imbeciles if their intent is to have the Democrats win elections, because even things like this, I mean, to allow Netanyahu to get these weapons now and to go into Gaza will clearly serve Trump's interests, because there are people like yourself, no doubt other KPFK listeners, and we know very significant populations in swing states who are prone not to vote for Biden if what you described happens and this goes forward. Now, if he is able to still have constraints, which in the long term, I think he's gambling on the idea that in the long term, even with the weaponry going to Bibi, but Bibi's not thinking long term, right? We know this guy's concerns are partly about his own staying out of jail, just like Trump's concerns are partly his own staying out of jail. And certain. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So, I mean, how do you see this all tying into a general – I mean, you know, it's true that Donald Trump has been catnip for voters. So in a society where, you know, our political dialogue runs through late-night comedians, right, Trump has motivated people to turn out in the last election at absolutely, you know, shattered the previous record for a turnout in an election. So – And you do have these polls that are, you can find pretty readily about, do Americans support democracy? And it's like 88% of the people support democracy, right? They don't want to live in an autocratic society where there's not the option to, you know, at least have the show of having the individual have influence over the outcome in an election and to be as such in a society of equals, right? That's the case. At the same time, the public dissatisfaction with the two major parties, the public dissatisfaction with Congress, and the public question, are politicians able to address the issues of greatest importance to you? At the same very time, you have 88% for democracy. Those are they're low. They're super low. I mean, I haven't seen the latest numbers, but I've seen teens at times, and they go up into the 20s. So there's no faith in our elected officials. So there's a real disconnect there. And by the way, I do want to say this too. I should say this. You know – and Mike, please comment on all this after I'm done. Trump is maintaining right now in his rhetoric to his base that he is the champion of democracy and that these court cases are we're a banana republic and all this stuff. And he's playing that like a fiddle pretty effectively, at least for his base. But in all of this, what's your sense of our democratic institutions' capacity to respond to the interests and needs of the people of the country? Oh, and have we lost Mike? We might have lost Mike. So who do we have next is Sandra in Torrance. And I just spoke too much, so I'm going to go to Sandra in Torrance right away. Sorry, Mike, if we cut you off or whatever. We're going to go to Sandra and then to Mark. Thank you for calling in, Mike. Sandra, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I started listening to you on the note of the baguette. And I hope they don't try to sue you for mentioning their name in a disparaging light.
Oh no, you're allowed. You're allowed to review restaurants, and you can say
okay.
Yeah, I'm allowed to say McDonald's. Okay. I'm allowed to say I don't like McDonald's food. How's that? They're
okay.
McDonald's consumer.
I hear that a lot.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, so as a Francophone myself, mm-hmm. and I know Paris is wonderful and beautiful, and people love to pay thousands of dollars in airline tickets back and forth to drink expensive coffee and eat cheese and bread. So I guess going to Paris in itself is elitist.
Oh.
So I would say, in my agreements to you about the cost of the bread, and because Paris and France stands for imperialism, and I don't know of any ex-French colony that is doing well for itself.
Right. No, it's a crazy paradox because there are elements of France where you see the tradition of the revolution still produce for the French domestic population some great benefits. But yes, my understanding is the colonial control and leverage pressure of the colonial state, France, against former colonies exceeds and is worse than in other instances for post-colonial societies and their relationship to their previous the previous colonizing state, the state itself. So, yes, keep going. You're correct, as far as I understand. Yeah.
And if they are thriving, if at all, and I use the term thriving loosely, maybe they can afford food and a house and a roof over their heads and some kind of decent education so that they can provide for themselves in the future, but their GDP is not high, and if at all, if they have an economy, it is a servient economy that is deeply rooted in hospitality and hotels and servitude.
You mean in the former colonies, correct?
Correct.
Right,
the former colonies.
Right. You know, I've seen articles about this in particular around the African, Francophone African former colonies. Yeah. Quite pronounced.
Correct. Right. As well as the Asian ones in the South Pacific with Tahiti and all that.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're all a subservient class of ex-colonies, pretty much. And they're all African and they're all Asian. The white ones pretty much are doing very well for themselves, like Belgium.
You know, there's crazy. The crazy things about France, too, is that, you know, of course, there's a treatment of Haiti historically, right, which has been horrible and heinous by France. And while, of course, the United States and its geographic proximity and its dominance of the Western Hemisphere, certainly in the past 100 years, means we have got incredible complicity in the state of Haiti to this day, as we all know, if anybody knows anything about Haiti. But France, of course, is the sort of foundation of the tragedies of contemporary Haiti. But the crazy thing is, within France, you have all of these things that you really would like to see adopted in many respects. I mean, I know that there, obviously, people take a lot of ethnic pride, and there should be incredible pride in the diversity of the United States, and maybe there's a way to do this that's sort of halfway between. But in the country of France, you know, there's these rules that you're not allowed in the to even register people's races as an anti-racist gesture within the country of France in terms of, like, how they do their census and stuff like that. And then, you know, as I just said, the bread and everything. And for people who don't know, within any contemporary non-communist economy, France has just about the highest level of state spending of any country, including the Scandinavian countries. So there's an incredibly large government, and that creates very low Gini coefficient. Obviously, the union density isn't that high in France, but the unions are very, very powerful. So these things are good within domestic France, but you're right. There's a huge divide. And, of course, there's this huge, massive, you know, terribly racist movement out of the National Front and its former and what its current configurations are, which, you know, pretty much are these, you know, almost like 35% of the voting population that says all that I just described that are beneficial in France should only be to the benefit of white French people. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Exactly. No, and if I may say so myself, as somebody who was married to someone who lived in France for quite some time, yes, they do not record your race, but the people who are processing your application will immediately have no application after you have called in and they assured you that there was a job or an apartment available. Once they see your race, they will say it's not available. So they have their eyes on the ground to make sure that they oppress you in any way, shape, or form that they can. So with that said, about the Republic, I think they ought to call it, imperialistique.
Thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And I suppose as I'm going to go out now, thank you for everyone who's called in. We didn't get to you. And I never really even got to the whole listing of the endemic crises in American society. And, per the last caller, of course, everything the last caller said, please keep that in mind as a rejoinder a little bit to what I'm going to say. Because some of these countries do have these kind of structures the last caller described, especially the Western European countries, that are nothing that we'd want in our society here in America, which, again, the good things about American society, the general sense of it being an open society, the heterodox exchange of ideas that you can get and do have within the domestic United States, and the fact that we're now almost certainly by normative standards of understandings of, you know, regional diversity and ethnicity, the United States is by a quantum degree the most diverse country in the history of the world, especially places like Los Angeles, which probably qualifies as the most diverse metropolitan area in the history of the world. And that is beautiful. And that's fantastic, and it only exists here. There are other things that are very beneficial about the United States. And one is I was sort of talking about the development of the household wealth averages in the United States in the post-suburban era. Look, huge sociological problems with suburbia. There's no doubt. Those are well documented. And I don't think that human beings have figured a way around that. The United States has the most developed separated house suburbia areas in the world. The population still seems very covetous of wanting to live that way. But it is suburbia that is the thing that elevates the average American household into basically a most stratospheric level economically compared to any other country's work, middle class. So you have societies that are much more balanced in their middle class status. And if you look at the other wealthy countries in the world, they are largely still the Cold War allies of the United States of America. So Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Taiwan, Australia, New Zealand, Western Europe, and Canada. Those are the other wealthiest countries in the world other than Gulf states, which are entirely driven by the commodity, the relationship to oil as a commodity. So that have developed, middle-class societies with middle-class institutions. Those are all constitutional republics. Make of them what you will. Many of them are former colonial powers. Almost all of them are, because, of course, Japan was too, in its own way. But if you look at a whole set of social indices and compare those countries, including with the Gini coefficient, the level of wealth inequality, homelessness, poverty, obesity, depression, divorce, if you want to throw that in, almost every social indices, mass incarceration and crime, gun violence, guns, so many, you can just check them off. The list is long. The United States is either near the bottom or at the bottom or way at the bottom. We are twice as expensive as any health system in the world for the average household. And we have horrible health results compared to all those other countries. Of course, almost all of them have universal single-payer health care. If they don't, they actually approximate it through another means. And we don't. It's insane. And so all of these things are not getting better. Some of them are so severe, like the fentanyl crisis, homelessness, mass incarceration, that any sense of this being a healthy society while they persist for all of its wealth, the political system's not addressing them, in my opinion. And what we need is something that doesn't break our political system the way the Trump MAGA movement does, but actually turns it towards being able to address these from within the system, reforming and transforming the system. That's my opinion. I really wish I could have taken more callers. And I don't know if it's achievable. And I only hope it is, because I don't think, with all the guns in the society, we're ready for the type of social conflict that would exist if we were going to try to recreate our political system in the domestic United States. I think that would be a really problematic situation for all of us. Okay, so I'm Alan Minsky. Please call 818-985-5735. And now hit number 2 and donate. Please donate at 818-985-5735. I want to thank Barbara Wampole and Tom Barron from Castaic. Thanks to everybody working at KPFK in this difficult time. I want to thank Jay Chops from Rancho Palos Verdes also for donating. Be like these people. Because the kind of questions we raised and discussed here, from the use of credit cards at businesses as classist, through to the whole questions about the structural problems in the United States of America and the capacity or incapacity of our political system to address them, an honest discussion of that that doesn't just, paint it over with nice, pablum, you don't get elsewhere. And therefore, in other media, only KPFK do you have the kind of dialogue that can take place with all of you all and this media outlet that can produce the social direction we need in our society and our time to address the climate emergency, to address the human rights abuses of our society like homelessness and mass incarceration, the maldistribution of wealth. Half the population is living at or near poverty. That's insane in a country this wealthy. We need a readjustment. We need to overcome the oligarchic forces in the society. And, let's also get really, really good baked items for $1.25 available for everybody, cash and free to the people who need them to be free, along with housing available for all people and so much more. Living wage, if you work one job full time a week with 6 weeks vacation guaranteed, you should have a living wage for sure in any sane society that's this wealthy, instead of having all the money and power accrue into the hands of the few. So I'm Alan Minsky here at KPFK Radio. Keep listening to the station. Let everybody know about this station. And I want to thank everybody here. Especially want to thank Mr. Gary Baca. A little tip of the hat to Terry Guy, too. And yeah, I'm not going to say I'm not, per that one caller with exceptional, very on-point critique of French ongoing imperialism. I will not say vive la France. Vive la démocratique révolution. How's that? Take it away, Gary Baca, and I'm out.